Ever since we discovered anthrax in the mail, Americans have had a new awareness and heightened fear of the possibility of biological and chemical attacks. Although it may seem like we're living in a new reality, chemical warfare played a big part back in World War I. My guest, Eric Crotty, is the author of the new book, Chemical and Biological Warfare. He's a senior research associate at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. I asked him to describe the chemical weapons that were used in World War I.
The first major chemical attack was chlorine in Ypres, Belgium. The German military basically hauled thousands of chlorine canisters up to the front and all at once opened them up when the winds were right and allowed a cloud of chlorine gas to drift towards the Allied forces. Chlorine really lost its effectiveness. It's a choking gas that primarily causes death through asphyxiation. Phosgene was another gas that was used to a considerable extent. Probably, however, in many ways, the more effective chemical warfare agent and used in large quantity in 1917 and 1918 was mustard agent. It's not so much because of its lethality, but because it caused so many contamination problems to the enemy, to either side, that it injured and incapacitated a lot of soldiers. So mustard, chlorine, phosgene are really the top in terms of actual battlefield use.
Mustard gas is what's called a blister agent, and that means what exactly? Blisters can be fairly harmless things.
Well, yes and no. It depends on the size and quantity of blisters, but also the infections that can occur following injury. And in World War I, there wasn't much in the way of antibiotic therapy, so this was a real concern, as a concern now. But mustard could be lethal, particularly in larger concentrations when it gets into the upper respiratory tract, and occasionally, given the right amounts, can go straight to the lungs and cause horrific damage. But by and large, you can think of mustard agent as being one that causes extreme irritation to the tissues, primarily through cell death down to the DNA level.
Were the Germans the only ones to use chemical weapons during World War I?
No, Germany was really in the best position to use them and to utilize chemicals because, as even now, Germany then owned a substantial market share in terms of a chemical industry. It's really remarkable how far advanced Germany was at that time in terms of dye manufacture, pharmaceuticals, and others. That gave them sort of an edge. But Fritz Haber, who was the father of modern chemical warfare, who worked for the German Wehrmacht, he too realized that, you know, Germany could use chemicals to a great extent and perhaps improve their chances in war. But he also told the German government that you better end this war quickly because the Allies will catch up. And so France, Britain, and America all sort of cooperated to develop their own chemical warfare agents to use as a responding in kind to how Germany used them on the battlefield. So it really was sort of a race, an arms race, if you will, in terms of developing chemicals that could be used effectively in the battlefield.
Did France or any other countries end up using chemicals?
Yes, France and Britain used them to a great extent. The United States supported. We were latecomers to that war, and we did what we could. But probably France and Britain were further along, much more so, in actual production and also tactics. The United States was sort of a slow learner in a lot of ways into the realm of offensive chemical warfare. Some American expeditionary forces did actually use some in battle, but it's sort of few and far between.
There were 500,000 Russian soldiers who were casualties as a result of chemical weapons during World War I. Do I have that figure right?
Yes. Russia and the former Soviet Union probably got the worst of it when it came to chemical warfare in World War I. And this is something that Solzhenitsyn writes about in November 1916. And in many ways, it helped to form the military doctrines that were to be later adopted in the Soviet Union by people such as Mikhail Tukhachevsky, who actually was the first to modify chemical warfare into some sort of doctrine. But yes, the experience that Russia had was really an object lesson in how for troops that are unprepared, chemical warfare can be extremely devastating.
So you think part of the reason why the Soviet Union built such an arsenal of chemical weapons is because they were the victims of it?
I think they had a lot to do with it, that they have memories of just how important these agents could be in a battlefield scenario.
You open your book with a poem by the British writer Wilfred Owen, and this is a poem about facing chemical agents in World War One. Would you tell us why you selected it and then read it to us?
Well, we excerpted that just because it is a classic, and no book on chemical warfare would be complete without it. It describes in very accurate and vivid detail, really, the effects of gas, not only on the moral psyche of the soldier, but down to its effects on the lungs. And you get this with pulmonary fluid being filled up because of the damage to the lungs. You also get a fair amount of fluid, a frothy, pink blood-tinged fluid coming out of the mouth. And so in those days, and even now, you can refer that to as dry land drowning. The damage to the lung causes someone to basically choke on your own fluid. And there's just not too many other literary devices that one can find that describes it so well.
So Wilfred Owen wrote this poem in 1918. Would you read it to us?
Certainly. The poem is titled Dulce et Decorum Est. Gas, gas, quick boys. An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning.
Now, the clumsy helmets that he refers to, what are they?
He's trying to figure into the manic and frenetic pace of trying to get your masks or whatever you had.
So these were gas masks that they were putting on.
Probably ensembles, correct. Not only just the actual canister and mask itself, but if there was other attachments to it, because you'd probably have to take off your helmet, put on the gas mask, and there was a lot of different types, some better than others. In the early days, they put whatever they could find onto cheesecloth and covered their nose and mouths. Sometimes even urine was used as a means to provide some kind of a chemical barrier between you and the gas. And of course, in this particular poem, there's some points here. Gas, for example, is still used as a warning. Regardless of what agent is used, you'd yell out gas, and that gives all your comrades the heads up to put on your protective equipment.
My guest is Eric Crotty, author of the new book, Chemical and Biological Warfare. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Crotty, author of the new book, Chemical and Biological Warfare. When we left off, we were talking about the use of chemical weapons in World War One. So chemical weapons were a very potent weapon in World War One. Were they used in World War Two?
Only in the Pacific theater, and to this is primarily the use of chemical weapons by the Japanese military against the Chinese Kuomintang and other forces in China proper. There are some reports that perhaps some Japanese soldiers threw cyanide at Allied forces in the Pacific War. None of this has been really confirmed, and certainly didn't come to any great effect. And the extent to which chemical weapons were used in China, it's hard to say what overall impact they made, but it was considerable.
During World War II, FDR pledged not to use chemical weapons unless those weapons were used against us first. But in 1942, he did threaten the Germans, saying that America would use chemical weapons against them if they used the chemical weapons against the Russians. What did we have that we were threatening with?
At that point, the United States had a considerable quantity of mustard agent primarily, plus some other World War I stocks. What we did not have were some of the newer nerve agents that Germany was developing almost precisely at that time. In a sense, the threat was, or at least the implied retaliatory threat, was very real, and it certainly was not lost on the German military. I think Roosevelt was just making sure that Germany understood that Russia, Britain, the United States were in it together, and that any attack on them was an attack on us. Now, Roosevelt said something similar to the effect that the use of chemical weapons by Japan against China would also be regarded in similar fashion, but we never really followed up on that threat. And to a certain degree, modern Chinese scholars and some in their security apparatus are still a little bit irked by that, perhaps.
Most countries would like to stop the production of chemical or biological weapons. On the other hand, several countries like the United States have nuclear weapons. And nuclear weapons cause immediate death to the people nearby, and a fast death to the people on the periphery, and then a slow and painful death to many others. And the numbers can be remarkably high in nuclear war. In your understanding, why are nuclear weapons still acceptable for some countries like the United States to have, whereas mustard gas or anthrax are considered unthinkable?
That's an outstanding question, and I think too few people ask that. Regardless of what one feels about it, I think it's a fallacy, at least a scientific one, to ascribe a certain moral outrage of one weapon system while allowing another. And the example you mentioned there, for example, mustard agent, its effects on the body are described as radiomimetic, that is, it mimics that of radiation, particularly at the level of the DNA and the destruction it does to cell tissue, and with repeated exposures can lead to cancers. So they're really not very far removed from one another if you think about it, if you get right down to how cells are injured and die. But I think the United States went through the same type of decision-making when Nixon renounced biological warfare in 69. He and Kissinger sort of looked at each other and said, well, we've got a very powerful nuclear deterrent. What's the point in messing around in the technology here that might only be used against us by some other countries? Maybe it's time for us to take the lead on this and see what we can do to slow it down. But that's a very Machiavellian approach to arms control, if you want to put it that way.
Machiavellian in what sense?
In the sense that giving up a weapon system with a means towards enhancing your own security advantage. That is, it's not so much of a morality play as it is to playing for your own set of cards. How are you going to stay on top of the security game?
You study biological and chemical weapons, you know, and how they've been used and what treaties have been come up with to try to prevent their use. Do you have nightmares about this stuff?
Not particularly. I think the nightmares I have, to the extent that I have them, are about more mundane things, about car accidents, my brakes not working. And these are the things that really bother me. And I think, you know, writ large, I think people should be worried about those things too, making sure your brakes work, making sure your smoke detector is still working. These are the types of risks that we really face. Chemical and biological warfare is still rather obscure, and it's an interesting subject, but as we try to promote in this book, we want people to understand it and not fear it.
Well, Eric Crotty, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Eric Crotty is the author of Chemical and Biological Warfare. He's a senior research associate at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California.